Welcome to the Slayer Report. Today is Thursday, May 9th, 2019. This is Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Our theme tonight is listening to the drumbeats of war from the other side of the world. I'm in Thailand. It's a long flight to get here. I arrived last Sunday. I'm on the coast several hours east of Bangkok on the Gulf of Thailand in the South China Sea. Thailand, go look at a map, is right in the middle of the rise of the land empire. So the yakety-yak and conversation about the Silk Road is going on hot and heavy here. It's in Southeast Asia, so south of China and east of India. In one sense, it's between China and India, but because China touches India over on the eastern side, it's you can't really say it's between China and India. But if you look in the map, in a sense, it's between India and the most dynamic part of China, which, of course, is all the way on the coastal line. At the end of April, essentially 2 weeks ago, the Belt and Road Forum was held in Beijing. That's the second one. And I believe we're now feeling multiple reverberations in the global markets as a result of the success of that meeting and the impact of that success on the Chinese now taking a hard line in their negotiations on tariffs and trade with the United States. One of the key things you hear coming out of the April forum in Beijing is an expansion of scope. Originally, the Silk Road was very much about infrastructure and particularly transportation infrastructure. The One Belt, One Road initiative divides into both the land aspect as well as the maritime aspect, but clearly it's the rise of the land empire that has tremendous implications. But China announced at the end of this forum that they were expanding the scope from infrastructure to services, technology, and international governance. Now, not surprisingly, right at the heart of this debate is the effort by the United States, with both themselves and their Five Eye allies in particular, but the other G7 nations, to make sure that Huawei's 5G is not present in the mix. And if you look at what has happened in the trade deal, China came back, took the 150-page plus draft, and basically deleted much, apparently, as reported by Reuters and some of the other news outlets, deleted much relating to specifics on intellectual capital law and, even more important, enforcement of the trade deal, particularly the intellectual capital. And I think one of the things they're willing to take a hard line on and affected them in their negotiations coming out of the forum is understanding they would rather dominate 5G and dominate telecommunications in a way that protects them and their networks from the Five Eyes system, whereas America is absolutely clear that their global dominance depends on the superiority and power of the Five Eyes system. So the rollout of 5G, particularly using what is Huawei, is the largest telecommunications phone equipment maker in the world. And of course, ever since Microsoft rolled out, it's all about the back door and who controls the back door. Another way to say it is who controls the one-way mirror, to use Glenn Greenwald's expression. Anyway, it's easier to finance a global one-way mirror than to finance all that big concrete and expensive infrastructure and railroads. And I think the Chinese, particularly because they're pinched in terms of the dollars that they can lend compared to the extraordinary needs if you're going to do all the cement and concrete projects, I think they're beginning to realize they've got to draw the line and play tough in terms of their intellectual property laws, their laws related to telecommunications. You know, they want to practice the trust me to comply, not give very specific enforcement powers over to the U.S. And I'm reminded of one of my favorite quotes about all of this from Nicholas Negroponte when he ran the MIT Media Lab. He said, "In a digital age, data about money is worth more than money." Anyway, so I want to keep talking about the Silk Road and then bring it back to why we're hearing drumbeats about war with Iran. China has been working to not only build out transportation connectivity in China, but across Asia into Europe. Remember, you have the largest consumer market in the world in the European Union on one side of Eurasia, and then on the other, you have the fastest growing consumer group in Asia, and, you know, 3-4 billion consumers. And then you have a giant Eurasian landmass in between. And what China has been trying to do is to improve the connectivity by building out the infrastructure. Remember, they've got railroads that can now go from China to Europe to London in 11 days, cutting the maritime shipping routes from 40 days down to 11 by going through the land empire. Again, part of this is maritime. So China understands the importance of controlling the sea lanes, and that's why there's such a big squabble and effort to control the sea lanes in the South China Sea. So the first forum for the One Belt, One Road initiative was in 2017. And let me just give you some of the statistics. It was attended by 29 heads of state, along with representatives from many countries. At the time, there were around 100 participating countries. And as of May 2017, China had signed 46 agreements with 39 countries and international agencies. Now, a lot of those agreements are the equivalent of memorandum of understanding, so that they're still fairly loose. Now we have 173 cooperating agreements, so it's up over 100, with 125 countries and 29 international agencies. And China has signed, so that's a total of 154, and they've signed 17 free trade agreements with 25 countries and regions, and they've got another 9 in negotiation involving 30 countries. So if you just look at how much has been accomplished in the last 2 years, it's significant. That includes many projects sort of on the drawing boards for multiple rail lines that link Asia, Europe, and into Africa. In March, Italy became the first member of the G7 to sign cooperation agreements. Japan has traditionally been the largest builder of infrastructure along in Asia and along the Silk Road. You can see from the announcements by China at the forum, they're responding to all the various criticisms, a big one being quality. That's the Japanese advantage, is the quality of construction, the quality of the engineering. But clearly, if you look at how ambitious the project is, there's a tremendous need for more money to fund all the projects. And I think that's one reason why you see this shift from just infrastructure to technology and telecommunications, is my guess, is part of that technology and services, because you're talking about getting a lot more bang for your buck in terms of the upfront capital requirements. And this year's forum had nearly 40 heads of state came, including the leaders of all 10 of the Asian countries. That's the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. A report from the Asia Times this week that the Asia Development Bank met in Fiji last week and came up with more swap agreements. Let me just describe. In pooling resources in Fiji last week at the Asia Development Bank's annual meeting, Asia finance ministers agreed to build stronger buffers into the swaps arrangement and perhaps increase the pool of reserves. Even more significantly, they took the first step to add the Chinese yuan and Japanese yen into the mix and reduce Asia's reliance on the dollar. It's the multipolar world. Let me give you an example of the speed at which the connectivity is growing. In 2018, the cumulative number of trips made by the China-Europe freight trains was a little bit more than 12,000, with annual shipments reaching US 16 billion. So this compares to 2011 with 17 trips and less than 600 million. So essentially, you've gone in 7 years from almost nothing to a significant capacity. And again, this is in the very early days, because there are many projects in the pipeline, including the high-speed rail link between China, Laos, and Thailand. But again, as I said before, if you can take by rail from China to Europe in 11 days, as opposed to 40 days by sea, that's a significant difference. And again, this is the concept of the rise of the land empire, because suddenly the sea lanes can't control, not to say that they're not still very important. Now, if you look at the map of how the One Belt, One Road initiative lays out and you compare it to some of the others in the same area, then you start to see the real power of this. The EU has the Juncker Investment Plan. Look up the European Commission Investment Plan for Europe. And then Russia has the Eurasian Economic Union, which is the landmass going north all. So if you look at the Silk Road along the southern Eurasia, then the Russian-led Eurasian Economic Union goes to the north of that. And that includes plans for a high-speed railway to go across Russia. In fact, Putin just signed off on a design for a Moscow-St. Pete high-speed railway. Now, one of the great competitive advantages of the United States has been the extraordinary low-cost and redundant transportation network inside the country. So our internal connectivity has been very, very powerful and much more powerful than Russia or China, certainly India. That's changing. Now, what are some of the concerns? Because you see very heavy criticism of the plans underway in Eurasia, whether it's the One Belt, One Road or the Russian, the one to the north. And that is the pricing and design of infrastructure projects can be very complicated. Let me just read in 2015 for the second quarter wrap up. Our topic was infrastructure. You might want to go back and take a look at it. It's a very good overview of what some of these issues are. But let me just read you our commentary. There is a war going on between the forces of control and conquest and the forces of collaboration and creation. History teaches us that civilizations which win at either generally get their infrastructure right. In fact, infrastructure may be the difference between life and death, the prosperity and poverty of a civilization. The United States has spent a great deal of money on infrastructure in recent decades, and much of this spending relates to control and conquest. U.S. telecommunications infrastructure is less reliable and more expensive than that of other developed countries, but it permits the NSA and a variety of private parties to collect and access intelligence. U.S. software is often buggy, but trapdoors provide access to intelligence agencies. In many areas, U.S. roads and bridges are badly in need of repair, but we have poured significant sums into secret underground bases. The United States has also developed a reputation for destroying infrastructure, whether destroying that of Iraq or other countries we invade, or decimating global communities with predatory lending and financial speculation, which cause severe dislocations in local capital allocations. Frustrated with the U.S., the IMF, the World Bank, and traditional global financial institutions, the developing world is taking matters into its own hand by launching and financing mechanisms for significant infrastructure investment. The BRIC nations are acutely aware that prosperity and environmental responsibility depend on significant and cost-effective investment in infrastructure. Opportunities to improve global connection via air, rail, roads, pipeline, phone, or space, and to integrate new materials and technologies beckon. China's successful launch of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and that's the bank that was created to serve the build-out of the Silk Road and the One Belt, One Road initiative, has brought these questions front and center. In this week's second quarter wrap-up, I will explore the subject and implications for U.S. leadership. The United States has produced a generation of leaders who have risen to power by cashing in on globalization, on natural resources in the developing markets and cheap debt, and relying heavily on the superiority of our weaponry. If you look at what must be done to succeed on the road ahead, we can ill afford such leadership now. As The Economist stated recently, quote, America's aristocracy is calcifying, unquote. The BBC's outstanding three-part series from David Hare, The Warwicker Trilogy, offers entertaining insights on this subject. In the series, the Gladstone Group, a syndicate of New Jersey businessmen and investors, are grossly overbilling the CIA for the construction of secret torture and rendition centers. A portion of this padding provides kickbacks to a global foundation to be launched by the British Prime Minister upon retirement. Shades of Tony Blair, question mark. This foundation's stated goals are, quote, humanitarian works, unquote. The Warwicker trilogy raises a critical question. We have piled up trillions of dollars in offshore havens and the bond markets. Now we must reinvest this money in the real economy. However, the real economy cannot produce significant returns without significant infrastructure. The long-term bull market in bonds and quantitative easing are over. Political kickback schemes may have worked for engineering the financial coup d'etat and accessing natural resources and privatizations in the developing and frontier markets. However, it will not work for reinvesting in strategic infrastructure investment that Mr. Global wants going forward, nor will skimming for Mr. Global, as opposed to for Mr. Global, be tolerated. China's leadership has primarily been trained as engineers. Engineers build bridges, high-speed trains, power and desalination plants, and spaceships. The U.S. leadership largely consists of wealthy lawyers. Lawyers make rules, pass laws, and litigate. And some of their laws create tax loopholes to fund global foundations and endowments. Which do you think we need? And interestingly enough, the 2016 election was between a builder and a lawyer, and the builder won. So one concern is the design and the efficiency of your infrastructure investment, because if you pour a lot of money into infrastructure, but you finance it with debt, and then you don't get the kind of economic development you need to pay off that debt and warrant the investment, a society can go very, very wrong. The second concern is predatory lending related to infrastructure, and part of it is because if you look at the G7 game and the U.S. game, we all know what the economic hitmans were. The lending for these development projects went in, sort of loaded up the local country with a lot of debt that paid American corporations to build projects that were great for large corporations or monopoly, but didn't really, weren't a great investment for that economy. If you read Naomi Klein's book, Disaster Capitalism, on disaster capitalism, or watch a great DVD that'll give you a great example called Life in Debt in Jamaica, or we publish an interview Greg Palast did with Alex Jones on some of the games the IMF and World Bank played in Latin America. So one of the concerns is that China's going to be a predatory lender. There was an article this week, just as the forum was finishing, in the Wall Street Journal that showed a list of external debt renegotiation with China. What it said was in 16 situations, the local partner got a write-off. 11 situations, they got a deferment. 4, denial of additional financing. 4, refinancing. 4, the terms were renegotiated. And 6, are continuing negotiation. Now, the article's argument was no significant sign of predatory lending, and certainly based on those numbers, it looks like it. But what you saw at the forum was a lot of talk about what sustainable debt is and how it was important to meet international standards of quote-unquote sustainable debt, which means don't make predatory loans. But it seems that China is clearly under the gun to make sure that the loans represent efficient investments whereby the equity created can clearly justify and pay off the debt. Anyway, so my theory is I think they came out of the forum ready to take a hard line on the trade talks. Now, you have various reports in the media saying, in fact, that the tough talk came from their interpretation of different things that Trump has done or said over the last few weeks, including sort of beating up on the Federal Reserve Chairman Powell for keeping interest rates down as an indication that our economy was soft, i.e., therefore, we couldn't afford to play a tough, hard line on the trade talks, or Trump saying nice things about Xi Jinping. I don't think that's it. I think, that you're seeing a real question of who controls the channel, both on the Five Eyes 5G system, so telecommunications, and sort of the one-way mirror related to control on that system, or who controls the channel in terms of the equity along the Silk Road. So I think this is really sort of a channel war, and whether it's the invisible telecommunication flows, the flows of trade through the South China Sea or across the Silk Road, I think this is about who controls, and China's willing to play long ball when it comes to particularly controlling the 5G and telecommunication networks that they're going to depend on with their trading partners here in Asia. And I think that played a very important part. There's a pretty good report in Reuters about the, basically, you'll see Reuters, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times seem to be covering this in detail. Let me just read you some notes. The diplomatic cable from Beijing arrived in Washington late on Friday night with systematic edits to a nearly 150-page draft trade agreement that would blow up months of negotiations between the world's two largest economies, according to three U.S. government sources and three private sector sources briefed on the talks. The document was riddled with reversals by China that undermined core U.S. demands, the sources told Reuters. In each of the seven chapters of the draft trade deal, China had deleted its commitments to change laws to resolve core complaints that caused the United States to launch a trade war. Theft of U.S. intellectual property and trade secrets, forced technology transfers, competition policy, access to financial services, and currency manipulation. The stripping of binding legal language from the draft struck directly at the highest priority of U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, who views changes to Chinese laws as essential to verifying compliance after years of what U.S. officials have called empty reform promises. Mnuchin also taken aback on the extent of the changes in the draft. The two cabinet officials on Monday told reporters that the Chinese backtracking had prompted Trump's tariff order, but did not provide details on the depth and breadth of the revisions. Now, the Chinese had been planning on sending a much larger trade delegation arriving this week. Instead, it was a smaller group, and they've come, they should have arrived today in D.C. So it's hard to imagine where this is going to go. What happened is that on the president's approval, Ambassador Lighthizer has filed the Section 301 update, raising tariffs from 10 to 25%. I think that's on $200 billion of goods, and they're threatening to raise more. Yeah, tariffs on $200 billion of Chinese goods would rise to 25% from 10%. That includes chemicals, building materials, furniture, and some consumer electronics. So this is a pretty deep rift. Trump has also threatened on Sunday to levy tariffs on an additional $325 billion of China's goods on top of the $200-plus billion already hit by import taxes. Now, what's the argument for U.S. leverage? One is the China's need for dollars. China's also suffering or dealing with a slowdown despite a lot of fiscal stimulus, and China needs to earn dollars, not just to finance the Silk Road, but simply to cover their debt service on dollar debt in their area. There's a piece from Bloomberg on the sort of what I call the U.S. dollar bear trap vis-a-vis China. But clearly, everyone's worried or concerned about a recession, and the reality is this breakup in the trade war is going to be expensive for China. It's going to be expensive for the U.S., and could it absolutely accelerate the recession into 2019 or early 2020? Yes. We see Pompeo warning the UK specifically about Huawei and 5G. And I very much think the AI superpower issue is at the heart of this battle. Okay, so what does this have to do with the drumbeats of war? Well, get out a map. Take a look at a map. What's smack dab in the middle of Eurasia? We've got Iraq, then Iran, then Afghanistan. So America has basically occupied Iraq, and it's occupied Afghanistan, and Iran is right in the middle. And control the oil markets and control the middle of the Silk Road, and you continue to control the reserve currency, and you're back to what the various oligarchs who seem to work through the U.S. Treasury want, which is the seven countries in 5 years plan. And that's going to include equity positions on the Silk Road, because all the players behind the various politicians are jockeying for control of those cash flows and those asset positions. So we're in the business of creating a toll booth effort in the Middle East and in the oil markets. And if you look at how many fronts that means we're fighting on, it's a lot of fronts to be attacking at once. You know, attacking at three or more fronts didn't work for Hitler. It didn't work for Napoleon. And I think the question as you look at what's going on in the Trump administration is, can it work again? I talked 2 weeks ago about Terry Mason's really great article about Pompeo's strategy for controlling the oil markets, and I would refer you to his article. I think it's very useful. We now have the third attempt to get our candidate in place in Venezuela. It's failed. Even Trump is now publicly complaining about Bolton's advice, saying, you know, that it was, he had been persuaded it was going to be much easier to switch in the or engineer regime change in Venezuela. Now we have Pence saying that Iran, accusing Iran of sending people to Venezuela. We see another carrier group and B-2 bombers or B-52 bombers headed off to the area around Iran. In the process, you're watching Pompeo, who is remarkably expressive, much more expressive than I'm used to seeing a Secretary of State be in a situation like this. And, you know, he sounds like having his own personal plane has gone to his head or something. It's, you know, James Baker can't possibly be advising this guy. So, you know, it just, he seems as somebody who's not used to having or playing a position like this. And, you know, if you look at Kelly Mattis or Tillerson, they would never be as verbose and interesting as Pompeo is being. You almost wonder what's going on here. Anyway, in the middle of this, we see Iran give an ultimatum to its European partners, the signatories on the nuclear deal. Again, the U.S. is the only one who's opted out. And they basically said within the next 60 days, they want to be protected against U.S. sanctions or they will resume high-level uranium enrichment. And I posted an interview with the Iranian foreign minister. It sounds very much like the Russian foreign minister, educated people who believe in the rule of law and listen to the United States, and the people who speak for the United States feel free to sort of make things up or spin. And you're kind of struck by comparing the Iranian foreign minister or the Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, to the John Bolton. It's an extraordinary comparison. One is fact-based. The other is, again, believes they can, don't have to be part of, quote, an objective-based reality. It's the Karl Rove theory of inventing the empire. The EU has rejected the Iranians' ultimatum and indicated they will establish an independent payment mechanism around the United States. That's a very significant step. But they're basically saying, you know, the U.S. sanctions are not going to stop us from buying your oil or trading with you. So whether it's the success of an independent payment mechanism around the U.S., U.S. sanctions and the dollar, what you're seeing is, as everybody needs to proceed with taking care of their business or building the future, you're seeing more and more pressure to move around the U.S. and around the dollar. Anyway, let me just read what the EU statement said. We strongly urge Iran to continue to implement its commitments under the agreement full as it has done until now and to refrain from any escalatory steps. We reject any ultimatums and we will assess Iran's compliance on the basis of Iran's performance regarding its nuclear-related commitments under the agreement. Anyway, it said its decision to partially respond or suspend its compliance was in response to the U.S. withdrawal and the failure of European signatories to alleviate the damage done by American sanctions. One of the things the foreign minister pointed out was that they had had very serious floods recently and that Iranian expatriates who wanted to send money to their relatives in Iran to help them were not allowed to do so. Now, what is the impact of what is happening in the United States on the world? One of the things you're seeing is that the incredible childishness of the Democrat versus Republican competition and the fights over the Russian canard and the Mueller report are making Americans look like children on the global stage. It's very, you know, sitting here in Thailand and watching it from afar and talking with people from around the world about it, it's very concerning. And I think whether it's the Asian Development Bank figuring out how to increase their swap agreements and bring in the yen and the yuan so they can continually decrease their dependence on the dollar, or it's concern that the sanctions are so many and impacting so people that it's just, you know, it's not a financial system, it's a control system. But I think the most frightening thing is one that the Iranian foreign minister mentioned in the recent interview, and that is that the U.S. is not a country that can make or keep a deal in a country where the politics are this brutal and this sort of changing from administration to administration. A U.S. agreement is only as good as long as that president or that Congress is in place, and it can change tomorrow. So U.S. deals are no good. U.S. contracts are no good. U.S., you know, basically always needs a scapegoat. And the U.S. is not capable of dealing with its real problems. I mean, if you look at what is going on in the sort of shriek-o-meter describing what's going on in Washington, we have real problems. We have U.S. students with serious debt problems who are not allowed to file bankruptcy. We have Social Security turning into a net borrower next year. You know, is the Fed just going to print the money? How's that supposed to work? We have pension fund ratios are dropping, and I could go on and on and on. There's no evidence of any significant Russian interference in the U.S. election. There's tremendous evidence of Israeli interference in U.S. elections and in Congress. Listen to the interview I did several years ago, 2017, with Cynthia McKinney. I flew all the way to Bangladesh to really sit down and talk with her about it. And she'll tell you, she describes what real interference is like. We're not talking about that. We're not talking about any of the real problems. Now, here's the question everybody's thinking. Can the deep state maintain full global power despite the Keystone Cop destruction of the global U.S. brand? And the reality is it depends. If you're watching what's going on, you almost wonder if the flak is not being laid down for the last round of asset stripping that you do before you bring it down. Someone asked me today, how long do we have before it craters? And I said, it's impossible to tell. We are in Never Never Land. It could be 10 months or 10 years or never. And it depends on the people in control, you know, who've basically stolen all the money and are in the process of what looks to me like stealing the rest. So controlling the federal credit mechanism is still worth a great deal. Why would you give it up if you still have firepower? But, you know, it comes down to who controls the UFOs flying around this planet. Your guess is as good as mine. So this is one of those situations where the desire for certainty is bound to get you in trouble, and we're going to have to embrace the uncertainty. The drumbeats of war are happening because the United States' position in the world is deteriorating, and the U.S. is fighting to establish and maintain their channels, whether it's the telecommunications 5i NSA channel or it's the channel of the sea lanes in the around the globe and in the South China Sea, or it's controlling the land empire in Eurasia by plopping yourself down and controlling Afghanistan, Iraq, and Iran. Okay, money and markets. I'm going to use the Wednesday close because it's still early morning in the States. The markets, the U.S. equity market's down about a point and a half. So just remember that, and I'll mention it as we talk through. So we're talking about the people moving away from the dollar, but the U.S. dollar index is strong. It's up 1.73% for the year. So we're trading, we've been trading, we're now up about 97.39%. On the U.S. dollar index, fixed income, the long treasury now up 3.28%. That's total return for the year. And the intermediate up 2.47% total return. The bond aggregate up 2.98%, so almost 3%. And then the yield continuing to be risk on at 7.55%. That's an extraordinary performance. Equities as of the Wednesday close, S&P up 15.55. As I said, it's off about 1.4, 1.5 today. So let's say it'd be approximately 14% up for the year. Home builders up 24.02%. European ETF up 12.45%. Germany up 11.76%. Developed markets minus North America up 10.84%. China small cap up 11.5%. Large cap up 8.55%. They're off more than a percent this morning. Emerging markets up 8.55%. Figure they're off by more than a percent. The commodities index backing back down. This is a trade war is very deflationary for commodities. So back down at 5.86. I'm sure it's going to be down more today. Gold is now down 28 basis points for the year and silver down 4.34%. We see, you know, when you cut off international sales of Iran, Syria, and Venezuela, or at least try to, you're going to run up the price of oil. And then, of course, you're going to end up with people having bidding wars trying to buy reserves. And sure enough, we see Occidental come in with a big bid on Anadarko and its Permian Basin assets. Quite a big deal. And Chevron just announcing today they refused to get in a bidding war. So I'm assuming Occidental is going to get that piece. But don't think that Pompeo didn't do a nice job for Anadarko's investors. Europe is in the middle of new elections at the end of the month. And so I think by June, we'll see a clear direction coming from the EU. Of course, we have Brexit wrangling going on in the UK with Nigel Farage creating a new party. That's going to make that all very interesting. Interestingly enough, we have the Dutch finance minister come out and say that the EU risks implosion. The Norway and Switzerland are not joining. Sweden and Denmark are not joining the euro, and the Brits are leaving. So a little truth-telling from the Dutch finance minister. I would tell you, I think what you're looking at is a technocracy backlash. The EU is the primary source of technocracy in Europe, just as the U.S. government is the primary source of technocracy in the United States. And whether it was the 2016 election or the Brexit, you're watching a real push back on technocracy, which we'll talk about a little bit in a few seconds when we get to the interview. Anyway, Notre Dame, I talked about in the first quarter wrap-up news trends and stories with Joseph. We took our discussion of Notre Dame and made a little video out of it that we put up publicly at Solari, and it's up at Vimeo and YouTube. I wanted to read you a comment that we got from one of the people who listened to it. Thank you so much for all your research in Catherine, but especially for this video. As a guide of Notre Dame of Amiens, I have the great privilege to explain to tourists our 13th century cathedral for 18 years now. My colleagues and I have not the slightest doubt that Notre Dame in Paris was lighted up. Oddly, the quote, accident falls together with restoration works making necessary the elevation of a high scaffolding, the first in decades. Without the scaffolding, nobody can approach the heights of the cathedral. The restoration team who works on it is made up of highly educated craftsmen going back in a straight line to the corporations and builders of the Middle Ages. They are all morally outstanding. I've had the occasion to exchange with them. They take each evening 2 hours of extra time after their workday to secure the workshop before they leave and reported several times to officialdom that they found their workshop time and again broken into and visited in the night before the fire. I also thought it would be of special interest for all the cathedral levels to discover that Dr. Stephen Murray and his colleagues from Columbia University have deeply studied our Gothic cathedral in France since many decades. She then sent me a short video, which I put out on my Twitter feed, but you can read this comment if you go to the comments section for the Notre Dame video up in the public section at Solari, you'll see it. As I mentioned last week, I think we've discovered that in 2016, there was a aggressive real estate proposal for Notre Dame and the Île-de-France. And now with the fire, it just happens to be something that could be possible with a change of laws and other rules overseeing the development. What a coincidence. Turning back to the U.S., we now see Barr, Attorney General Barr, sanctioned for not appearing in Congress. He was cited for contempt. I've been looking at some of the Democratic attacks on Barr's handling of summarizing the Mueller report. And frankly, if you look at their behavior, the only thing that makes any logical sense whatsoever is that essentially they went to a significant effort to stop Trump and take him out. It failed. In the process, many laws were broken. Now the executive branch gets to investigate and hold accountable. And we could see a significant number of people, I suspect both Republican and Democrats, go to prison for this. I'm not saying that's what would happen. But if you look at the insanity of the behavior, it speaks to the seriousness of their political and legal and financial liability. And it looks to me like a group of people who are exceptionally scared and cannot afford for the truth to come out. So this could turn into a very serious food fight that's going to waste a lot of time and hurt us publicly. I don't see how such an investigation, if you do a serious investigation of the FBI, I don't see how it could be over quickly. If you look at the polls, 17% of Americans want Congress to begin impeachment against Trump. 48% want Congress to move on and do their real work. And 32% want them to keep investigating. So my read is the Democrats made a very significant mistake 2 years ago. But given that they've put themselves in this corner, I don't see any indication of it changing. As we discussed over the last 2 weeks, the president's two candidates on the Federal Reserve, which were a little bit unorthodox if you look who the typical candidates are, both went down. But Stephen Moore, who had been one of the people who developed the tax proposal that the administration succeeded in getting passed, published an article in the Wall Street Journal called My Brush with Personal Destruction. And it talks about how vicious and ridiculous the process has become in Washington. And it's worth taking a look at. But basically, when you read it, what you realize is many, many people are going to decide they want nothing to do with working in Washington or being part of the governmental process in the United States. And I can certainly see why. Some interesting news. The Ninth Circuit Federal Appeals Court has now ruled that the U.S. administration can return immigrants to the Mexican side while they wait for their asylum to be adjudicated. If you look at the number of immigrants who've been turned loose and sort of allowed to come across the border and then turn loose while we're waiting for the courts to hear their case, who never then reappear, it's a very high unprecedented numbers. I think it's about 170,000 plus now. So there's a real surge of people coming into the U.S. across the southern border. And so the Ninth Circuit saying, okay, it's a matter of law that they have to wait on the Mexican border before their court case makes a lot of practical sense. There has been a rise in mainstream coverage of UFOs. I have no idea what it's about. But I will tell you, when Bloomberg starts publishing articles about UFOs, something's up. And so I'm going to keep an eye on this and be talking with various people about it. But if you see any mainstream coverage of UFOs, I hope you'll send it in or let us know or post it in subscriber input. Our interview. I have wanted to have Patrick Boyd on for a long time. He is the author of two very fine books on technocracy. If you look at our best books for 2018 or our best books for 2019 in our annual wrap-ups, I have recommended in both years his Technocracy Rising, the Trojan Horse of Global Transformation. Basically, We are watching an effort by the U.S. leadership and working very much through particularly the federal government, but in many different forms, to basically convert the way that we're organized from one of democratic process or markets into one that's really managed with algorithms and rules. It's technocracy is a giant system of micromanagement. And the beauty of that, this kind of micromanagement, particularly if you have digital systems AI and sort of deep learning AI, what it allows you to do is it allows you to micromanage in a very centrally controlled way and shut off communication between people, because one of the greatest communication devices ever created was the mathematics, whether it's the mathematics of the voting, honest voting machines, or the mathematics of price discovery in a real market. And many of us who are used to price, honest prices or markets or democratic processes, we are watching a very Orwellian world where, as one Goldbug said, there are no markets, they're just interventions. So this really, reading Technocracy, listening to Patrick Wood, helps you sit back and say, look, this is really happening, this is what it is. And if you're a small business or a doctor or a lawyer who is dealing with the incredible shadow work created by the rollout of Technocracy to sort of micromanage you and what you do, it's really helpful to see the game. And I think Patrick has done an incredible job in integrating information from many different areas and industries and places and expertise, and he really does help you see the game. It's a brutal, ugly game, I know, because, you know, you just wouldn't believe how much time and money at Solari we spend on, you know, technocratic shadow work, but it is what it is, and if you're going to outwit it, you got to see it clear. So I really encourage you to listen to this one, and to, if you're having to manage a technocratic, you know, spiritual, legal, and financial warfare, get one or both of Patrick's books and take a read. Our hero this week, I discovered in a wonderful article that Dr. Joseph Farrell wrote on lab-grown meat to hit the shelf soon. The Mississippi Commissioner of Agriculture and Commerce, Andy Gibson, announced that he was exercising truth and labeling laws so that nobody in Mississippi was going to buy lab-grown meat without knowing it was lab-grown meat. And apparently it's just Mississippi and Missouri. All the other states are allowing it to get slipped into, you know, into the shelves where you think you're buying meat, but you're not. You're buying something else. It's kind of frightening. In Let's Go to the Movies, I wanted to just present Gaslight. Gaslight is a Ingrid Bergman movie. It was published, I think, in 1942. It's pretty old. But it was the reason everybody knows the term gaslight, which is, let me just read it, a form of psychological manipulation that seeks to sow seeds of doubt in a targeted individual or in members of a targeted group, making them question their own memory, perception, and sanity. Now, gaslighting is one of the tactics that you see the media and the intelligence agencies use to outwit individuals who stand in the way of technocracy and other forms of tyranny. And in 2 weeks, we're going to be publishing Deep State Tactics 101, and I'm going to cover gaslighting more at that time, so I'm not going to talk about it. But if you haven't seen it, this is one of the great movie classics and critical to an understanding of this sort of tactic of trying to persuade perfectly sane people that they're crazy. And getting them to buy into it, getting them to buy into the crazy. I'm always telling people, please don't buy into the crazy picture because you're not crazy. Just because you're not mind controlled doesn't make you crazy. And don't let anybody put that picture on you. So I don't want you being gaslighted just because you understand what's really going on. Anyway, if you haven't seen Gaslight, it's a total classic. Gotta see it. Okay, ask Catherine. A lot of good questions today. In the run-up to the midterm elections in late 2018, there was considerable talk about how the Federal Reserve was putting the brakes on the economy by raising interest rates and shrinking their balance sheet. And yet the adjustments to their balance sheet seem modest. And I'm not sure I understand how adjustments to the balance sheet would be anything but neutral. Can you explain? Let's assume that they have been modest, because, again, in a post-FASB 56 world, I'm not sure I believe any of the numbers, particularly because there's so many offshore entities with which you can play games or off the books now that FASB 56 is in place. You have 170-plus agencies and public benefit corporations and other kinds of entities that can be used to play all sorts of games. Anyway, if you look at the situation that the central banks were in, simply not, remember, if you're an addict, what you depend on is the next injection. And as the Fed was injecting money, the balance sheet was expanding because they were injecting money through the quantitative easing by buying bonds. And those bonds were expanding their balance sheet. Now, when you sell those bonds out or you let those bonds mature, you shrink your balance sheet. And what is essentially putting the brakes on is you're not delivering the next injection. You stop delivering injections. So, you know, if you just stop, then your balance sheet changes are modest. But for the addict, the absence of the progressively or the absence of the steady injections is a major, major change. And it shows you how incredibly dependent certain sectors of the economy were on that constant injection. Anyway, so I see modest changes in the balance sheet could be very not neutral. Okay, next question. Thinking about China's strategy vis-a-vis trade with the United States, I can only assume that either the Chinese believe that Trump will not be reelected in 2020 or that they accept the mainstream neoliberal economic view that tariffs will be unsustainable due to U.S. domestic inflationary pressures. Strikes me as pretty dumb either way. In fact, I'm mystified in that their actions support Trump's objectives by encouraging higher U.S. domestic economic activity and employment. The only other explanation I can come up with is Chinese leadership feel that the same globe will shortly undergo a crashing recession. You know more about this than I do. Any comments? I think they know that the intellectual property law and enforcement thereof is at the heart of who controls the one-way mirror and therefore then the currency, and it's all part of the AI superpower battle. So I think control of the Chinese and Asian 5G platform and the ability to route stuff outside of the Five Eyes system is worth the cost of a war. So I think they're planning on hanging very, very tough on this issue, and it has more to do with what happened at the forum and the feedback they got at the forum at the end of April than it did with, you know, sort of any tweets by Trump. Now, it's very possible they have backdoor deals with the American establishment, including with Biden's backers or, you know, sort of leadership in the deep state. So it could reflect deals behind the scenes with various interests in America. But I think more than anything, what it reflects is America and China don't trust each other because neither of them are trustworthy. You know, when you look at the deterioration in trust in America as a result of the sanctions and regime change and so many of the other things we've talked about on the Solera report, you know, make no mistake about it. Go around the world. Look at how chilling everybody feels in Hong Kong. China's not trustworthy either. So the Americans still look like a much better deal than China. The problem is they're looking more and more unstable and like they can't make and keep a deal. And the childishness coming out of the media in Washington is very sobering. But America and China don't trust each other because neither of them are trustworthy. You know, how are we all going to build collaboration and get things done in a world where that's where there's that much worthy untrustworthiness? Dear Catherine, I recently composed a lengthy email to a friend on a controversial subject. When I went to attach a YouTube video, all of the relevant YouTube links were suddenly blocked as a certificate area. I then tried to access some websites. The more controversial ones were blocked while more benign websites were available. I gave up on the link and sent the email, but it vanished when my computer was restarted. The certificate and blocking issues disappeared. but the operating system clock included the month, year, and time zone had changed. I'm using a Microsoft operating system. Other things I've noticed in the past, links disappearing from my favorite folder, iPhone Safari URL autofill not working for certain websites in the lead up to the midterm elections. Regarding the PC, presumably Microsoft had loaded software updates onto my computer, but there must be more to it than that. This cannot be the result of human intervention or even algorithms, AI. I assume that a great deal of the funny business I experience is AI. Sounds very much like all the different stuff I'm dealing with. I would, frankly, the faster you get off of Microsoft and into open source, the better off you'll be. If you want to understand more about these kinds of things, I would definitely check out Zero Days, the documentary on the Stuxnet malware. And I would read Michael Thomas's Black Money. It's a sort of beach thriller, but it'll help you understand the early days of Promise Software. And then watch all the movies and documentaries about Snowden and what Snowden had to teach us. But the sophistication of the software to manipulate on a one-on-one level, I would say there are 325 million targeted people in America and divided between those who know they're targeted and those aren't. But if you've ever listened to or watched stories of what it was like to live in East Germany, if you watched the movie The Lives of Others, these days you don't have round-the-clock teams of human beings basically doing surveillance on you. You have round-the-clock 24/7 surveillance teams that are all basically software programs and wetbots, and they're trained and organized to steer and optimize in a whole variety of efforts. That's all part of replacing markets and price with technocracy. And technocracy is basically going to be and is being implemented by AI and by software. So yeah, it sounds like you've got your Stasi software team on your tail. But don't feel targeted. It's everybody. Hi, Catherine. This is an alternate Vitruvian Man theory guy again. And more on that theory, I put your email in last week's, and then I'm adding it here. So if you're interested, definitely check it out. Hi, Catherine. I apologize for taking so long to get back to you, but wanted to get you good information. This is about medical malpractice. I've been reading Marty McCary, MD's book, Unaccountable, which is a really great read. On your recommendation, I've bought it, but I haven't had a chance to read it. And you've got the link in here. And then the other doctor, which I've followed for a long time, is Susanna Humphreys, MD. Yes, I think she's terrific. Her book on vaccines is in the recommended reading, and I put that link here. So both of these are very helpful. I very much appreciate your sending them to me. And if you have any more ideas, keep them coming. Then a long email that basically says, we're worth every penny of what it costs to subscribe. I'm so glad it's helpful, and I thank you for your kind words. Okay, that's it for May 9th. Next week, Community Currency with Paul Glover. Paul was the founder of Ithaca Hours, one of the most successful attempts at community currency since they flourished during the Great Depression. And we had a mayor in our network who wanted me to do a little bit more on currencies. I'm going to be doing the second quarter wrap-up on currencies, so a time to really set off and take some more time to look at currencies. But I wanted to get this interview with Paul. I was in Pennsylvania during December, and so we did the interview then, and we're going to run it now. Then I'm going to do Deep State Tactics 101 with just myself. I've thought and considered a lot of people to do this with and thought, no, I'm just going to do this myself. When I wrote the Missing Money Personal History, which is now finished, and you can find it at hudmissingmoney.solari.com, or we put up a commentary on the website, I thought I would end it with a section on tactics, and it got so long, I said, nope, I got to do a separate Solari report. And in fact, if it gets too long, I may divide it in two parts, because what I want to do is I want to go through all the different tactics you use to suppress a story or herd people in certain directions and do it in such a way that you can start to see it in your own life and protect yourself. I want you to be very, very good at predator evasion. So maybe I shouldn't call it deep state Tactics 101. I should call it Predator Evasion 101. And then the emerging multipolar world with Saker, given what's going on in the Middle East. Very interested to hear what Saker has to say about the sort of the drumbeats of war and growing tensions with Iran. So until next week, Community Currency with Paul Glover. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. Thank you.